Welcome to the Cannabis and Pain Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Abhimanyu Sood. My clinical practice, education, and research work focus on the intersection of chronic pain, opioids, and substance use. We are very lucky to be joined by two experts in cannabis and pain for today's podcast. Dr. Laura Murphy is a pharmacist in an interprofessional chronic pain clinic at the Toronto Rehab Institute, and is a clinician investigator and pharmacy clinical leader at the University Health Network. She is also an associate professor at the Leslie Dann Faculty of Pharmacy. In her clinical role, she works with many people who use cannabis, providing education and recommendations. Her current research includes the development and implementation of a structured program for community pharmacists to provide integrated pharmaceutical care for people using cannabis. Dr. Amol Deshpande is a clinical investigator also at the University Health Network and an assistant professor at the Department of Family and Community Medicine at the University of Toronto. He's been practicing pain medicine for over two decades and has a particular interest in neuropathic pain, which we'll talk a lot about today. He has published several peer-reviewed papers on cannabis and chronic pain and remains cautiously optimistic about the potential benefits of this plant for carefully selected pain patients. All right. Welcome, Laura. Welcome, Amol. We're really excited to have you on this podcast about cannabis and pain. Good evening.
Good evening.
Thank you. Remind me. Appreciate it.
I'm really happy to have you here. I think there's a lot for us to dive into about how cannabis works, particularly how cannabis works for pain. But I think an important thing for us to cover off first is, what is cannabis and what are cannabinoids?
Laura, do you want to go on that one?
Yeah, sure. I think this is a really important question, and it comes up, very often when we start to look at like the evidence, and when we start making recommendations, but they're often used interchangeably. So actually, cannabinoids is the overarching term for all substances that work within the endocannabinoid system. And so that includes both pharmaceutical grade cannabinoids, cannabis, plant-based products, and others. And sometimes all of these things are lumped in together with the use of the term cannabinoid. Cannabis is actually the plant-based product and extracts of the plant-based product, and is really very much focused on the products that are now more recently legalized.
Got it. So cannabinoids are what work on anything that works on the endocannabinoid system. Is that a good way to capture them?
Yes.
And that includes cannabis?
That's right.
Okay, so what on earth is the endocannabinoid system?
So I like to think of the endocannabinoid system as doing like five main things for our body. It really helps us to eat, to sleep, to relax, to forget, and also to protect. And it's a really complex system that occurs naturally in our body with lots of downstream effects on other hormonal and other signaling systems within the body. So, when we hear, cannabis is a natural product and we have receptors in our body for it, that's commonly why cannabis is touted very widely. It is true, we do have this endocannabinoid system, but it is so complex that we're just beginning to really understand all of the downstream implications of activating those receptors in that system. I don't know, Amol, if you wanted to comment on your perspective as well.
Yeah, I think you've covered it. I guess there would be sort of some common, I'm not going to quite call them myths, but I'm going to say misconceptions, some that you've pointed out, right? One is that THC is just an example of a cannabinoid, as is CBD, but there are many others that unfortunately we don't know what they do. And that also gives rise to our sort of poor understanding of how cannabis, the actual plant, which has multiple cannabinoids, works on our system, because we've really only focused on two of the cannabinoids and arguably only one, which is THC. So I think that's important to understand that, all the things you've said, while we do have the neurotransmitter system in our body, it does all those things. Those receptors are very ubiquitous all the way from the central nervous system to the bones, to the muscles, to the gut. That's often why you get both the benefits as well as the downside effects when you take cannabis. And unfortunately, you can't control one without the other. So it's important to sort of realize that with patients.
So hold on a second. Is there anything else besides things that are derived from cannabis that work on the endocannabinoid system?
Meaning, just to clarify, you mean other active like molecules?
Other molecules that are not from the cannabis plant, besides what we have, what maybe have been manufactured, but naturally occurring molecules that work on the endocannabinoid system that don't come from cannabis?
So that's a great question. And the answer is most likely there are, and they're sort of cannabinoid mimetics. There's not a lot of work done in that area, but some of the examples are like PEA, ethanolamide, there it is, which doesn't necessarily just come from cannabinoids, but it does work on cannabinoid receptors. And there are others similar to that. So there is some interplay, but if you look certainly at a structural level, the molecules can be very similar, but they're not truly classified as cannabinoids per se.
Wow. And so, and the endocannabinoid system, like how does it interface with you, Laura, you mentioned your hormonal system, but like other major like interface points of the endocannabinoid system with other kinds of receptor or other kinds of systems in the body?
So, you know, because there are actually two types of cannabinoid receptors, CB1 receptors and CB2 receptors. We know CB1 receptors work primarily in the CNS, so the central nervous system and the peripheral nervous system. And so the downstream effects there are really that they're working in the brain, you know, to elevate mood. They might increase food consumption, but they're also working in like the adipose tissue to promote lipogenesis, in the liver, in the GI tract, and even in the immune system via the CB2 receptors. And so there you might even see like effects on the inflammatory response, cytokines, T cell migration. In addition to that, there are also some cross reactivity with other type of signaling systems, like I mentioned. So, you know, in terms of hormone production, but also even opioid receptors, which is maybe something that we can get into a little bit later in the podcast.
So this may be the wrong question to ask, but I'm going to ask it anyways. So are cannabinoids medicines? Or let me ask the question differently. Is cannabis a medicine?
That's a dangerous question to ask depending on which side of the fence you're on.
That's why I'm asking it.
Yeah. So I'm going to say no because cannabis is a plant, right? So it's just like sort of foxglove. It's like any, you know, a lot of our medicines actually sort of derive from plants. So, you know, I would argue cannabis, the plant, is not a medicine. But when you start to extract the active ingredients out of that, and then we talk just solely about THC, or we talk about, you know, cannabidiol, which is, you know, CBD or THCV, or all the umpteen cannabinoids themselves, then certainly I think you get into a much grayer area, but I think closer to the idea that these are medications per se. And one of the, you know, you highlighted it before, I think quite appropriately, is, you know, you talked about or a synthetic cannabinoid. So if we talk about nabilone, which is a THC analog, so it's not THC, but it mimics THC, so it binds on the CB1 receptor. That is clearly a medicine, and it's regulated by Health Canada. It has a DIN, but it only has one function, and that is to bind to the CB1 receptor. So, you know, when you start to get down to the molecular structure and the molecular compounds, I would argue that indeed you start to move more from sort of plant into true medicine.
Yeah, I would agree with them all. I think, you know, you already mentioned it. The fact that cannabis, the plant product, has neither a DIN, a drug identification number, or a natural health product number, an NHP, you know, really means that it is not a medication. But more of a plant. Does it have medical properties? You know, that's where we start to look at perspective, I think. And we know that certainly it does have effects in the body. That's, you know, that's already very clear.
So let's jump to cannabis for pain. it's obviously one of the things that people talk about the most when they talk about cannabis as a medicine, or cannabinoids as medicines, are its analgesic or pain relieving properties. How do we need to be thinking about cannabis for pain these days?
Big topic. So just as sort of some brief background, I mean, if you look at cannabis, and again, we're talking about the plant now, in terms of its analgesic property, that's probably the most common use if we go back in history, all the way back to China 5,000 years ago, that cannabis has been used. And that's why it's been sort of propagated that cannabis is really useful for pain, simply because historically that's what it has been used for. And if we look at all the jurisdictions, both with sort of medicinal as well as recreational use of cannabis, the primary reason for using cannabis, whether you're in Colorado, whether you're in Ontario, whether you're in Alberta, and there are multiple studies to this effect, is pain. And that ranks as sort of, you know, 90% of individuals use it for pain. And then there's a huge gap to the next level, sort of anxiety, nausea, sleep, but pain by far stands out.
Is that because pain is so common, or is that because of what people think about cannabis and what it's useful for?
So I don't think that's been thoroughly looked at. If you're asking my opinion, I would say it's because pain is so multidimensional. It has sort of not only a physical component, obviously a sensory component, it also has an affective component. And if you look at some of the studies, we won't get into them now, but some of the studies suggest that, maybe not surprisingly for a lot of people, but maybe for some, is that it has a strong affective component. And if you look at, you know, when we ask for a pain rating simply, when it's six, there's actually multiple components built into that six that sometimes is hard for patients to tease out. And there's a six, which is the sensory, or sort of what I'm going to call the physiological, for lack of a better word, component. And then there's the affective component, which is the emotional component. And cannabis often works on both. So that I think is often the reason why people will choose cannabis, because it does have that sort of multi-factor effect. So I think that's one reason. Two, if we do look at the evidence, I think what should be clear, and what everyone should really know and encourage their patients, is there is absolutely no evidence of cannabis being effective for acute pain. So if you break your leg, if you lacerate your arm, if you get a dental extraction, if you fall and you get a hip fracture, cannabis is not what you should be, you know, encouraging your patients to reach for, and certainly dissuading them from reaching for that.
And none of the cannabinoids either.
That's correct. Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And in fact, I'll go one step further. And this probably happened most recently in January of last year. There are now no cannabinoids, synthetic or otherwise, that are recommended for pain. So the only one was Sativex for pain and MS, and that actually was rescinded by Health Canada in January. So now it's only indicated for MS and spasticity. And I realize we use a lot of things off label, but it is interesting when you know, Health Canada rescinds some of this based on lack of evidence.
Yeah, that's very unusual. So why did that happen? Was it a change in the interpretation of the evidence? Did new evidence come out?
No, I assume they went back and they looked at it, and there really is not, you know, incredibly robust evidence to support its use in chronic pain. The studies are mixed, and you know, we can talk about that in terms of cannabis now. Most of the studies, so there are umpteen studies, there are about sort of 40, last I checked, sort of 48 to 50 formal RCTs. The majority of them are fairly small individually. In total, there's probably about sort of 10,000 patients out of all the RCTs. But there's a huge skew in terms of size of each of those studies. So some are like less than double digits, and others are maybe sort of 100 or 200 in size. And in terms of what they look at, we know pain is heterogeneous. It's not just one entity. We talk about sort of neuropathic pain. So that's from damage or lesions to the structural nervous system. We can talk about nociceptive pain. So it's kind of like when I poke you with a needle or the dentist extracts your tooth. And so cannabis doesn't seem to work across all conditions. And most of the evidence, and again, albeit it's not robust, but most of the evidence really falls in the context of neuropathic pain. So this, you know, for people listening, might be something like post-herpetic neuralgia. So the pain that you get after shingles. It might be diabetic peripheral neuropathy. So the pain that, you know, some of your diabetic patients may experience at night. That tends to be where most of the evidence for the use of cannabis comes as an analgesic, at least based on today's evidence. The challenge is we just don't have a lot of evidence in other areas. So it's not as equivocal as it is in acute pain, where they've actually shown just cannabis doesn't work. In a lot of those other chronic pain conditions that aren't nerve related, we really just don't know.
I think too, it's also very difficult because there's a lot of overlapping use, right? Like you were mentioning, you know, a lot of people are looking for the effective side, and you know, people often are using it recreationally as well. In addition, for therapeutic use, they may be using it to help their mood. They may be using it to help their sleep, and like you mentioned, you know, all of those things can actually help to improve pain. So it's a very tangled picture when we're only looking at studies that examine pain ratings and very short-term studies that are available out there. I think clinically, we also see, you know, people with a history of trauma, you know, often have comorbid chronic pain. So they come to us with pain, they have this history of trauma, they may have been using cannabis long term, but you know, I think what we see is that there might actually be a dissociative effect that's happening with the cannabis, and they're taking advantage of that. So it's not necessarily that their pain has decreased, but they maybe are, you know, feeling that dissociative effect. So it's not necessarily impacting their life the same way or impacting their function the same way. And so I always find that an interesting relationship, but one that, you know, the evidence not necessarily going to bear out the same way.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's an excellent point, Laura. You know, sort of anecdotally, you know, I've probably not doing as much as I used to, but if I often got into the habit of asking my patients, and they can often tell, you know, are you you're taking cannabis, are you getting an analgesic response? In other words, your pain is actually less, or I just sort of tell them, or I ask them frankly, you know, is your pain there and you just don't care about it? And I'd say a third of patients are in that latter group where, you know, they'll actually think about it. If they're honest with themselves, the pain is there. They just don't care. And I think that that's a very valid point. And that's sort of where the, you know, it has that effect. As you said, sort of Abby, it's where is it working? Sort of, it's that dissociative emotional aspect, which again, you know, as a clinician, you can say it's good or bad, but the point is it's not acting as an analgesic.
Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily want to take us down another path, but if I could just add on, you know, I think that those are all the benefits that we might associate with cannabis. You know, on the other side, we also do see that people using cannabis, just like they use other substances with either dissociative effects or, you know, CNS effects like alcohol, opioids, other medications recreationally, they're actually using it as a coping mechanism for their pain. And so, you know, that becomes kind of a shift, right, in terms of whether it's actually a beneficial effect of the cannabis or it shifts over into a risky use of the cannabis. So I think that, you know, that coping or using chemicals to cope with pain and the impact it has on people's life, you know, when we really look at it, we always try and reassess over time. You know, I try and ask people, like, is this doing more for you or is it doing more to you in terms of your life? And I think that that's something that we always need to reassess, especially with people who are using it kind of both recreationally and for their pain.
So building off of that, Laura, so one justification for using cannabis, if you're thinking about it as a, you know, way of coping along multiple dimensions using a substance as well, isn't cannabis preferable to alcohol? Isn't it preferable to opioids? That's kind of one way that cannabis has really been positioned, is that amongst all the ways that that people need ways to cope because of, you know, how much trauma people are exposed to or stress that people are exposed to or pain that they experience and they need ways of coping, can we favor cannabis because it's relatively, compared to other substances or other ways of coping, not as harmful?
Yeah, like I think from a harm reduction perspective, there are advantages to using cannabis over opioids or using cannabis over alcohol. And I think, you know, on an individualized case-by-case basis, certainly we see that some people, and the evidence has shown this as well, you know, substitute cannabis for the use of other substances. But of course, other substance use disorder also predisposes people to cannabis use disorder as well. And so I think it just all needs to be really looked at from that individualized harm reduction perspective, because when it gets translated to like a myth that cannabis has no risk, that cannabis has no safety concerns, I think that's where When we see widespread use in the population, it becomes quite troublesome for some people, and there are unnecessary risks that are taken. So, you know, certainly there are people who should maybe not be using cannabis, but, you know, I just think that quite often it's seen as natural and safe when really, like we mentioned, all those downstream effects in the body can lead to risks. And the route of use can be associated with some of them, like certainly smoking. We know there are lots of harms associated with that. People with severe cardiac disease, you know, we know that that can exacerbate some things. It can have effects on the immune system, and we don't really see a lot of that. And then, of course, you know, from the recreational literature, we know that, you know, up to 50% of people who are using cannabis daily may actually have a cannabis use disorder, and they may experience withdrawal when they decrease or stop their cannabis suddenly. So
I saw that number, Laura, in your notes as we prepared for this podcast. That seems like a very high number, that 50%. You know, I know a lot of people who use cannabis daily, and to think that half of those people have cannabis use disorder seems like a really high number.
Mm-hmm. So that, like I mentioned, is not necessarily for people who are using it for pain, but that is coming from data from the state of people reporting using it recreationally, using standardized tools to diagnose it. And we do see it. People coming into the hospital whose use is either decreased or stopped abruptly, you know, they do experience cannabis withdrawal symptoms. And, you know, we often try and see if we can replace it, like with a synthetic cannabinoid product, to really help relieve some of the restlessness and anxiety that they might experience.
So you brought up something really interesting. You said, you know, this is from the recreational literature and may not be the case for people who are using cannabinoids medically. So when we think back to some of the early messaging around opioids for the management of chronic pain, one of the big messages was people who have pain and are using opioids, it's like they're sort of filling an empty, an empty bucket. People who are using opioids for pain cannot develop an opioid use disorder. Have you heard or seen that kind of messaging around cannabis as well? That, you know, if you're using it, you know, medically or using therapeutically, we shouldn't be so concerned as we would for somebody who's using it recreationally around developing cannabis use disorder?
No, like I think, well, I hope that we've really learned from that history. And we know that people who are using it for therapeutic or medical purposes are not necessarily different from those who are choosing to use it recreationally. I think where I made the distinction is because, you know, that study population specifically was only related to people who are reporting using it recreationally. And so, you know, where it may not translate as much as maybe the product selection versus people who are using it strictly for medical purposes under medical supervision, or, you know, the route selection, maybe the dosage of, for example, THC that people are reaching for. So, you know, I think there may be some nuances, but I do still use that number and still screen all of my patients who are using it for medical purposes with standardized tools like the QDIT-R. It's like an 8-item tool that screens for cannabis use disorder, really just to...
That's QDIT-R, CUDIT-R?
Yeah, it's free, available when you search it. And yeah, I think that screening is important for everyone, for those using it recreationally only, for those who, you know, share with us that they're using it for medical purposes, and for people who are using it for both.
Amol, can we talk about, Laura just mentioned something about THC concentrations. That's a really big issue because from what I understand, most of the studies have used very, you know, a lot of the RCTs that you mentioned use very low, comparatively low THC concentrations. But the products that are available, you know, both in the medical market and the recreational market are, you know, 20, 30 more or even more percent than that. How do we need to be thinking about this?
So I think from a healthcare perspective, I think we actually need to stop thinking about percentages, to be honest with you. And we need to start thinking more in milligrams like we do every other medicine, well, at least most medicines that we prescribe. So, if I were to ask you, you know, what's worse if you take sort of, 1 gram of 20% or you take, 2 grams of 10%.
10%. Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, but they're the same, right? Because if you do the math,
right,
you're taking 200 milligrams either way. So, right. If we were to kind of compare that to opioids, it's like that saying, well, which is better, 180 or 240s? Everyone would look at you with three eyeballs. Like, well, what do you mean? Right. So I think we need to really start getting a little bit sort of deeper into the weeds as clinicians and really start asking sort of the deeper questions. So, the percentages really come off of the old recreational days when people were growing this, in their houses. And that's sort of a number that's stuck. But in terms of, we bring into the healthcare system, it's really important we know about milligrams. And it's important because when you look at those studies, going back to your original question, most of those studies suggest that from a pain perspective, most patients get analgesic benefit below 30 milligrams a day. And so when you start talking about the amounts that people are taking in the 200, 300, 400 milligram level a day, that's far beyond what the studies would suggest is effective or required for analgesia. But when you talk about percentages, it becomes, again, confusing because somebody could say 40%, but if they're taking, I'm exaggerating, I shouldn't sort of do that, but let's just say they're taking 20%, but they're taking a minimal amount of it versus 10%, and they're taking much more of it. The 10% is actually worse, right? Just simply because the overall quantity they're exposed to is much higher. So, having said all that, I think in general, I would absolutely suggest a lower concentration is better, but that's simply probably because you have a little bit more control over it, right? In terms of how much I take. It's hard, I can only get it so small. If I've got a very high concentration, I'm still going to get more. So in terms of, again, parsing it out, you're better off with a lower concentration. But I think as healthcare, we need to really talk about milligrams to really understand what they're being exposed to, because ultimately that's the important piece. And the other thing
need to think about is then the route that you take it, because
absolutely,
I mean, a smoked 15 milligrams is very different than a oral 15 grams.
Yeah, it is, and unfortunately, the challenge there is the pharmacology is very much different between those two routes as well. So it is not a direct translation, and in fact, it often becomes very individual in terms of how someone will respond to inhaled. And I don't recommend anyone smoke, so I'll just talk about inhaled and they should be vaporizing versus taking something ingested. So I think that absolutely has to be sort of thought about as well. So I've had patients.
So do we need a morphine equivalence kind of thing for cannabinoids?
Well, I mean, you mean from one cannabinoid to the other?
Yeah, well, I mean, one cannabinoid to another, from what one route to another. Like, I mean, we have conversions for parenteral versus oral opioids.
Yeah.
And also, of course, other kinds of medications. We need something like, it sounds like you're suggesting we sort of need something like that for cannabinoids to sort of
I agree. I think that would be great. I don't think the research has caught up to that level. And that's part of the challenge. And the part of the other challenge is, as I said, it seems to be so heterogeneous in terms of how people metabolize it. But I absolutely think that would be very useful. I think the first thing to do is people, like I said, should just get in the habit of stop asking percentages, because it doesn't tell me what they're really exposed to. If the person's taking 5 or 10 grams a day, that's very different than someone who's just taking, a lot of my patients take like 0.5 gram a day, right? And the entire day, 3 times a day. That's not a big deal, right? In terms of dose wise, when I say big deal. So I think as clinicians, we just need to get in that habit, but I think conversions are very important. The other thing I would just sort of highlight, just so people know, when we talk about percentages, it only really, I mean, only refers to THC and CBD, none of the other cannabinoids, right? And so when I talk about those pain studies, when we talk about the literature, it's interesting. They only looked at THC. We have no information. There's no data, no studies on CBD. So
for pain or generally speaking?
Yeah. For pain, there are for CBD, but they're probably more, and I'm going to say the mental health field, so in anxiety and depression. But even then, it's actually quite sparse. So we talk a lot about it in the media, you'll hear about it, but there's really not a lot of robust data on CBD. And the only exception I will make out of that is obviously for seizures, and that's what Epidiolex is all about. So, right. Taking seizures off the table, we really, really are sort of, grabbing around in the dark about these other cannabinoids and what they do and what they don't do.
Yeah, I just, if I could just add on, I just wanted to make 2 points. I think, at the beginning when we talked about cannabis and cannabinoids, Amol, you're absolutely right. What I left out is that cannabis, the plant product, is not just one thing. It is a combination of 85 active compounds in different amounts, depending on the product, the plant, where it's grown, the environment that it's grown in. And it's not standardized, right, in terms of all these percentages and amounts. And, it kind of creates this soup, right, where everything is interacting together. In addition to that, it has like 200 other types of compounds that we would call things like terpenes and flavonoids. Being a plant, like all other plants, has all of these different active compounds inside of it. And so, very difficult to tell the dose, like you're mentioning. Now, we do have products that are now available from licensed producers that people can access. And like you said, they generally only quote the percentages of THC and CBD. And because they're not well standardized, like I have to share as a pharmacist and a clinician, they are very difficult to actually extract that information that you're saying is so important, right? That milligram information. And I have to say, and advocate for the role of the pharmacist kind of within the use of cannabis realm, because unlike every other pharmaceutical product, we're actually removed from the distribution and therapeutic assessment of the cannabis product, right? It's direct to consumer from the licensed producer. And the way that it's authorized is really just a total quantity and not necessarily a specific product. Our patients actually have a really difficult time telling us, they might know the percentage THC or CBD of their current product they're using. It should be on the label, but it's not always very clear on the label. I have to do a lot of very complicated math with a lot of the products that people bring to me, or I have to look it up on the different licensed producer websites. So I love that you're advocating for us assessing the milligrams, but those are the 2 points I really feel like are important. I have to advocate for the role of the pharmacist to help that patient kind of interpret, like, what is it that they're using and what milligram strength do they have? And I'm really trying to, empower all of my pharmacist colleagues to actually include this as part of their therapeutic plan and document somewhere, the milligrams that they're using. But also, it's kind of a call to action to standardize the labeling of these products. So sorry if I go on a bit of a rant there.
No, that's great, Laura. Obviously another thing that pharmacists will often think about and as part of a clinical team can be very helpful with is thinking about drug interactions. What do we need to be thinking about for cannabis and possible drug interactions?
Yeah, definitely. With all those active compounds, certainly they are, like Amol said, metabolized in the liver, like other medications. And they are metabolized through our cytochrome P450 system, which actually can involve a lot of drug interactions. We don't have a lot of clinical cases or we're not that aware of the clinical implications of a lot of these drug interactions. We just know that there is the potential for them. But I do know of several case reports, for example, of interactions with immunosuppressants, which we know can be very clinically significant for some patients. So anytime I see people on immunosuppressants, I often ask about their cannabis use. We also know that smoking itself or tobacco, which is often mixed, if people are smoking with cannabis, can induce cytochrome P450-1A2 or CYP1A2, and that can have impacts on some antipsychotics. So we know that there can be some clinically significant ones from a pharmacokinetic perspective. But I think the most concerning ones that all clinicians should be aware of and screen for would be the dynamic interactions, like the overlapping clinical effects of cannabis. So things like alcohol, opioids, gabapentinoids, really any of the other CNS depressants can have overlapping effects with cannabis. And this can actually impair people, it can sedate people, can have impacts on driving. So certainly a lot of our interprofessional colleagues, really should be aware that this use and these drug interactions can have significant effects on how safe people are to drive, how safe people are to be able to work in many safe, sensitive settings. So, you know, I think that this is something that as clinicians, we all need to consider.
Amol, I'm going to ask you this question about driving safety and cannabinoids. How do we need to be thinking about, you know, besides asking, you know, sort of understanding what kind of effects people have from using cannabinoids? Like, do we need to be thinking about certain dose thresholds? Do we need to be thinking about frequency of use? How do we assess driving safety for people who are using cannabinoids?
Well, you're asking the tough questions today. These are
questions that will be helpful for me too. Yeah. So.
No, I mean, it's again, a hot topic, right? I mean, a lot of people are trying to assess because cannabis does affect people differently. Number one, it often does stay in the body longer and not necessarily cause impairment. These are big questions that, you know, we as a society need to know. Certainly from a clinical perspective, when I'm onboarding someone who is cannabis naive, I generally give them 8 hours from the time of first ingesting that cannabis. And if they get euphoric effects, I'll suggest they should wait longer than that before operating a vehicle or using heavy machinery. That kind of is my sort of default position. And then as they get comfortable, when I say comfortable, I mean sort of stable on a continuous dose, then I'll, you know, much like we do with opioids, you know, you can kind of take the brakes off a little bit. Obviously, you don't want somebody taking the opioids within half an hour driving into a car as it's, you know, just getting absorbed. But you don't necessarily have to wait the 8 hours, you know, if they've been naive before. So, you know, if you want to kind of keep a number in your head, I would definitely say sort of 8 hours in Health Canada is a little bit longer than that. I think most clinicians, though, certainly sort of 8 to 12 hours is what they would feel comfortable with. And again, if they're euphoric, then all bets are off. You need to tell your patient, and that's obviously having a much stronger response. And I'd sort of avoid, any driving until that sort of euphoria settles down and goes away. But in terms of, you know, in terms of relating it to a specific dose, in terms of relating it to a specific route, we don't have any data on that. Certainly the one thing I would caution is that while we think of cannabis oil working roughly sort of, if you look at sort of the pharmacological data, sort of up to 8 hours, there are studies that suggest it can remain in the system for as long as 24 hours with effects. So while these are case reports, I still think it's important for people to know. So if they've never had it before, it certainly might be worthwhile telling that person not to drive for a day or two until they get used to it if you're consuming an ingestible as opposed to inhaled. Because there are,
and so is that going to be the case also if you're titrating up the dose too?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Whenever there's a titration, absolutely. Yeah, I completely agree with you. That's often my recommendation. So until they're on a stable, steady dose at a steady frequency, without any euphoric effects, again, I will caution them from driving and operating heavy machinery. You know, I don't want the crane operator going up there as he's just being onboarded over the weekend if he's still getting some euphoric effects.
Right. Laura, are there any groups of people who really, you know, the harms or the potential for harms really outweigh the potential for benefit and really should not be thinking about using cannabinoids for those folks?
That's a great question. Again, you know, unlike other medications, it's less clear. But I would say that people who have a history of or an active cannabis use disorder, you know, I think that authorizing cannabis for medical purposes is probably not a good idea. You know, again, there needs to be that individualized assessment. I think that women specifically who are pregnant or breastfeeding, we would say that would be a contraindication or should not be used. People with a severe cardiac disease, you know, we worry about the hemodynamic effects of cannabis use. And, you know, I mentioned people who are on immunosuppressants, but, you know, although not a contraindication, I do think there needs to be some consideration related to risk. You know, if people are immunosuppressed and they are using the dried plant product, I think that, you know, we worry about things like fungal infections. So there are people where risks are greater, but I think if you looked in the monograph, there is actually a Canadian Pharmacists Association monograph. You know, there are very few contraindications listed.
So wait, I had no idea that cannabinoids have hemodynamic effects.
They do.
Yeah.
There are. I mean, there's actually some really interesting literature, not clinical, but sort of preclinical. There are actually cannabinoid receptors in the myocardium. So absolutely there are. And certainly they're, you know, again, this is problem is they're small, they're experimental, but certainly if looking at inhaled cannabis, there is some suggestion that they cause vasospasm in the first hour after inhalation. So certainly if there's a cardiac issue, inhalation is probably not one, as Laura was mentioning, that you, you know, you want to recommend, you'd want to sort of recommend a different route of administration. And certainly people initially can often get sort of tachycardic as well. So that's something you have to sort of think about. But there are absolutely cannabinoid receptors in the myocardium. So and now on the flip side of that, there is some suggestion that they actually might be beneficial for some cardiac issues. So again, this comes to sort of the pleiotropic effect of cannabis is it just potentially does a whole lot of good things, but it also potentially does a whole lot of bad things. And we really haven't sort of sorted that out yet.
Rummaging through the weeds.
Yeah, pretty well, sort of.
Sorry, I couldn't help myself there.
Yeah, it's all right. Good dad joke every now and then.
Yeah. Actually, it was a Laura joke. I think that's from yeah.
Okay, all right. Good mom joke. Okay.
Yeah,
I'm guilty.
So you know, bottom line, what I'm hearing is when we're using cannabinoids for pain, really we have the most evidence for neuropathic pain, and even within that, like certain kinds of neuropathic pain. Because you know, this is, you know, something I had gotten used to was that there was actually reasonable evidence not just for spasticity but also for pain in MS. So that's new for me. And so I mean, there are all kinds of neuropathic pain. You mentioned diabetic neuropathy. You mentioned postherpetic neuralgia. You know, is a judicious clinician who is following the evidence and where there's evidence for benefit, is it really for pain, is it really going to be restricted to a couple kinds of neuropathic pain at this point?
No, I mean, I think you're going to have to, again, I think you're going to have to, you know, use your clinical judgment, but I don't think you can really say sort of any neuropathic pain is out. Certainly if you look at the Canadian guidelines for neuropathic pain, cannabis is sort of the third level after sort of adjuvant treatments and opioids. Some are strongly advocating that cannabis actually be number two. I think the challenge with that is we're in a world where people are so keen to run away from opioids. And on the other side is just cannabis. So it's hard to say, are you really running towards cannabis or just running away from the
other
side? Are you
just moving away from opioids?
Exactly. So and I honestly think we're in the running away from opioids, and I don't care what's on the other side. Which is why I think we need to just sort of be careful how we think about this. But I would say I am, you know, certainly cognizant of sort of the numbers Laura gave out, and I'm dissuading them because I think there's a lot of numbers out there. The number I often quote to patients for cannabis use disorder is 9%. And if you look at opioids, guess what? It's 9% too. So it's certainly not zero, but there's some really good work done by Wayne Hall out of Australia. Looking at a lot of the literature and coming up with that 9. So my point simply is I'm not so, you know, just like opioids, I think you need to be vigilant. You need to be smart about it. You need to do proper assessment. You know, it's not the, cause you have pain, you can't get addicted fallacy. That's completely incorrect. I think you need to be aware of it. You need to inform the patient about it, but I don't think it's the reason not to do something. So I think you need to sort of judge the patient in front of you, determine their risk, determine their pathology. But a specific neuropathic disorder would not kick them out of that bucket, and then you know titrate appropriately and watch as they go and monitor their outcomes. But whether it's post-stroke pain, whether it's spinal cord injury, diabetic neuropathy, post-herpetic neuralgia, the studies were done that were mixed, and a lot of these people were kind of thrown into the same bucket. So it would be hard to peel one group out specifically.
Mm. I think too, you know, as we were preparing for this podcast, you know, Mal and I were talking, and, you know, it's not necessarily people that are coming to us in clinic, you know, and we have some overlap in terms of our clinical, our clinics, but not much, but it's not necessarily people who are coming to our specialty pain clinic asking to trial cannabis. Most of the time when I take a best possible medication history and I include asking about cannabis, you know, people have either already tried it or they're already using it. They may not, you know, be seeing benefit yet, or they may need guidance to help them titrate the dose or look at the product that they're using. But more often than that, not, they're either already using it or have tried it and felt like it didn't work for them in the past. So, you know, it's not usually a decision to start it. I don't know, Amol, if you wanted to expand on that.
No, I think you're right. I mean, we talked about it, right? I mean, I would say certainly, definitely over the last year, probably over the last 2 years, relative maybe 5 years ago, a lot of my counseling with patients is really about either harm reduction, or they're coming in asking a question about cannabis. And by the time I'm done, most of them will say, yeah, thanks, but I didn't realize that there wasn't a lot of evidence, so I think I'm going to wait. So a lot of people, I think, are sort of backing off as well. A lot of people, whereas 5 years ago, it was basically, I'm coming in here. I want you to prescribe cannabis because my family doc won't give it, or whoever won't give it. So, you know, go ahead and do it. And if you don't, I'm going to go somewhere else. That attitude seems to have gone away, because obviously if they really want it, they can, you know, go to the local dispensary or retail shop and get it. So now I think the ones that are coming into the office truly are curious. They want to know from a health perspective, does this have benefit? What's the indications? Is it right for me? And so I think it's our job as clinicians to inform those patients appropriately as sort of what the risks and benefits are, and not just sort of say, you know, that's not something I do and walk away. I don't think that that's a very good sort of clinical perspective to have on cannabis.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there is, even though it's widely available and people can access it, you know, quite privately or confidentially, you know, they don't necessarily need to talk to healthcare professionals. I still think there is some stigma, particularly, you know, across different cultures, you know, with, you know, people of different ages related to cannabis use. And I do think that they may bring it up to clinicians, but I hear even from our colleagues, you know, they might bring it up to whatever clinician they actually feel most comfortable with. So, you know, that might be their physical therapist, there might be their OT, it might be their social worker. You know, it may not necessarily be their pharmacist, and I'm really quite aware of that. Though, you know, I'm finding that's shifting very rapidly. People are much more open about it over time. But that's why I definitely agree with you. I think it's the responsibility of all clinicians to be aware of good information about cannabis and evidence-informed information and these harm reduction approaches, because there is so much information available to people on the internet, you know, from friends, from family. I think, you know, it's really the responsibility of clinicians to help kind of cut through all of that information and really help connect people with the right information to help them make those decisions. So it's a really good point.
So any good resources you mentioned the QDIT-R as a tool for assessing for cannabis use disorder. Any other kinds of tools or resources that people listening to this podcast should think about?
So
go ahead.
No, go ahead, Laura. I was just going to mention the CAMH has a great low use guidelines, which although they're meant for adult use or recreational cannabis, I think a lot of them are very applicable to medicinal use as well. So I that's certainly a good cheat sheet, for lack of a better word, for I think clinicians can use and keep in their office. And they've got a one-page poster out for that as well, so it's kind of handy to have in your back pocket. Then the other one I would use, which I think is a bit longer, it's older now. It's certainly probably a little bit dated, but I would certainly still recommend it, which is the I'm going to call it a white paper by the College of Family Practitioners. And I think that's going back to about 2014 maybe now. So again, a bit dated, but I think it's still got some pretty good information. And Health Canada also, if you want to really get deep into the weeds, as you like to say, it's got some really fascinating and really, really good information on their website.
Yeah, no, I would definitely agree. I think that the cannabis lower risk use guidelines from CAMH is my go-to as well. And the white paper too. I would add on, there is then that monograph that I mentioned that's available through RxTX, like where you would previously access all of the other monographs for medications, and it's quite comprehensive. Also, all of the pharmacists across Ontario were mandated by our college to do education starting last year related to cannabis. So that has prompted a lot of our professional organizations to actually put out great one-pagers and practice tools, including the Ontario Pharmacists Association. I believe the CEP also put one out, and there are some resources as well from the Ontario College of Pharmacists. So those are ones that I also go to quite commonly as a healthcare professional.
So, Mol, you know, there may be some therapeutic benefits for cannabis for some select populations. But you know, for the most part, people don't have coverage. I mean, you know, access and coverage for medications, for the cost of medications, is an issue across the board. But there's very little sort of coverage for cannabis, and it can get quite expensive. How do you work through that with patients?
So there's no real sort of shortcuts. I mean, it is if you're going to use it for a chronic condition, you're going to use it on a long-term basis. Depending on what you use, you're certainly going to be around the $300 a month mark. So on an ongoing basis. So most of the LPs or licensed producers, those are the ones who sort of grow and have licenses to sell the cannabis. If you go through a medical authorization form, they do have compassionate programs. They'll vary from one to the other, but on average, I'd say they're about 20% discount. So there may be some benefit to getting medically authorized as opposed to going to the, you know, Ontario Cannabis Store or going to your own retail. The other thing to think about for patients and for you as a clinician is if you do provide a medical authorization, you can get a you get a tax relief from that, because it's not, it's considered a medical product. So those are really the only two reasons to get a medical authorization in today's world. Because I think the one, I think, important thing to sort of maybe say, because I think patients often get confused about this, is they assume that the cannabis, the medical cannabis versus the recreational cannabis, is different cannabis. It is not different cannabis. It is the same cannabis. And I think it's important that when we talk about
same medical producers.
Yeah. I mean, they may grow a different plant, but it's the same, you know, it all goes back to the same. But there's this notion that, oh, the medical cannabis is different. Well, it's not. You know, it's often important to tell patients that the medical versus recreational refers to the type of use, not the actual cannabis. So you know, I will tell them that. And if that's the case, and, you know, they don't plan to be on it long term, or they just want to trial it, a lot of them will just go to the dispensary or OCS or go on their own and sort of muddle through it. Again, I don't always recommend that without any counseling, because the bud tender, which is what they're often called in the dispensaries, don't often have a medical background. So I still think if that's the, you know, if that's the, it's the right, certainly right of the patient. And if that's what they want to do, I think that's important. But I think there is still a role, whether you're a PTOT, social work, dentist, to sort of, you know, educate them a little bit as much as you can within that brief time that you have them. So when they go into that store, they still understand kind of what they should be picking and what they should be staying away from.
So this has been great, both of you. Thank you so much. Any last words of wisdom that you can share with our audience?
Laura, do you want to go first and
sure. No, I think I would say, you know, talk to your patients openly, ask about cannabis use routinely. You know, try and address, you know, the stigma that might exist related to cannabis use, to, you know, develop that therapeutic relationship and allow people to share that information so that you can work with them to help reduce harms related to cannabis use as much as possible, and identify things like drug interactions and monitor people for adverse effects. But also really support people if they want to trial cannabis, really to look at it like a therapeutic trial, and really try and over time, you know, document benefit that they may get in, you know, an objective way in terms of either pain or function.
Wow, she took away all my thunder. Just gone, like just zap.
Sorry, I was on a roll.
Yeah, I see that. Should have pushed you off that roll.
Sorry.
Yeah, no, but I think you're bang on, right? I mean, I think that's it. I mean, I was just gonna, you know, say a very high level, kind of 30,000 foot level. I think it's important for everyone, you know, to know about cannabis. It doesn't mean you have to prescribe it. It doesn't mean you have to feel comfortable authorizing it like anything else you do. You don't have to do everything from soup to nuts, but it's good to understand how these things affect your patients and know about it. Laura's absolutely right. Ask about it. We're doing one survey and we asked them to list all their cannabis products and they said they're not on cannabis. And then I don't know how it came up, but one of the assessors kind of was just asking for the form back and they just started talking about cannabis. She said, I'm not on cannabis, I'm on CBD. Well, you know, it's just there's a huge gap between what patient knowledge is and what cannabis is. So if you don't ask, they won't tell, and it's not because they're hiding. It's just they consider it a natural substance. They don't consider it medicinal. And the last thing is, I think there is a goal, as Laura said, to sort of demystify this, both the, you know, the good and the bad. But I think it's, you know, if we just push it away, I think we're going to be perceived as having a bias, you know, towards the healthcare system, and given all the issues with sort of opioids and all sorts of other things that have happened with traditional medicines, I'm not sure that's winning us any benefit, any sort of points. So I think, yeah, you know, just as a clinician, even if you're not going to prescribe it, know about it, ask about it, and demystify it. I mean, I think that's what you need to do as a good clinician.
Words to live by.
I hope so. My kids don't, but that's right.
This has been great. I mean, I think this could be really long. We talk about so many interesting things, but I love this type of, I really like doing this topic this way. Thank you so much for making this.
This is great.